Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by the Chief of Staff of the IRR, Mr. John Endres. John, how are you? Or Dr. John Endres, actually, sorry.
Thanks, Alex. I'm very, very well. Thank you. And thanks for inviting me back on the show. It's been quite a long while, and I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, no, always great to have you on. And of course, we also have Mr. Herman Pretorius. Herman, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I was just, you know, just a few minutes ago thinking to myself how, you know, sometimes you have to impress your bosses to keep your job. And then completely unrelated to that, I thought, my goodness, John is really a good chief of staff. But yeah, no, so I'm well. I'm privileged to still be employed. John is just brilliant at his job. So it's, you know, just an honor and a privilege to be here.
Yeah, I'm making notes as you speak, Herman.
See, I didn't realize you were here, John.
At the IRR, we pride ourselves on not having a culture of sucking up or anything like that. Anyway.
No, it's just mostly fear.
Let us get into the news of the day. And, of course, we must begin with the scandal which is rocking, I think, the health ministry and the health minister and the country. And that is allegations that have been, I think, written about in the Daily Maverick over the past couple of months, that a company called Digital Vibes, which is allegedly run by close associates of the health minister, Dr. Zweli Mkhize, was given a 150 million rand contract to provide communication services to him over the year. This despite the fact that many of the services which they were contracted to provide should normally already be provided by the department and ministry staff. I mean, they do have, I know from my short time in government that every department has an enormous number of communication staff. So there was some redundancy. And of course, Health Minister Zweli Mkhize announced today that an internal forensic audit had uncovered that the contracts awarded to Digital Vibes were irregular and that there was at least 37 million rand paid to Digital Vibes that constituted fruitless and wasteful expenditure. Mkhize went on to stress, he says, that he was not personally involved in the decision of awarding the tender, and that he didn't do anything wrong here, but that mistakes were made in the ministry, basically, is the line he's taking. So let me start with you, John. Of course, Zweli Mkhize has also been pushing for the implementation of the national health insurance, the NHI, and this would put a lot more power and a lot more money in the hands of the health ministry and take it away from the private sector. I have a feeling that this somewhat hurts the credibility of that plan. Am I right?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that, Nicholas. The NHI is an extremely ambitious government program that seeks to centralize effectively all medical services and related products, manufacturing and services in the hand of the state, and thereby creates a very large centralized opportunity for malfeasance, for corruption, and for theft. And that is one of the stringent criticisms that has been raised against the idea of implementing this scheme. And for now, the minister to be implicated in quite a large corruption scandal, I think does undermine the credibility of the entire scheme. We must add at that point that the minister himself at this time, I think, has not been personally implicated, but the associates who have been implicated appear to be trusted advisors and people that he has worked with closely for a number of years. And I do wonder whether that association might not have been an arm's length relationship, but rather a closer relationship than that. It certainly seems that the directors of this Digital Vibes company were able to leverage their relationship with the health minister into securing some very lucrative deals in which they provided overpriced services to the Ministry of Health. And some examples include facilitating a speaking slot effectively for the Minister of Health on the state broadcaster at a price of over 3 million rand, which really strikes one as quite unusual because it is the minister's job to give such briefings. And one would expect the public broadcaster also to make such slots available and not have to be asked to pay for that. So I think the story is quite an intriguing one, and it really casts a lot of doubt over the feasibility of implementing the national health insurance.
So my pet theory about the NHI and why it's William Kesey himself has been pretty keen on it is because William Kesey, many people may not know this, but he actually tried to run for president of the ANC as a kind of compromise candidate, I think, between Zuma and Ramaphosa. And he didn't really get anywhere. But being in the NHI will force basically all medical services to go through government at some point, the decision to pay them or not. And that would potentially open the door to an enormous patronage network, which William Kesey would, in theory, sit atop of. Therefore making him one of the most powerful people in the ANC's internal politics in the country. Herman, is there any validity to that theory? And do you have any other thoughts on the scandal and the NHI?
Nick, I think you're absolutely right. We know Zweli Mkhize has presidential ambitions. That's a known quantity. And we also know that the larger your budget as a cabinet minister, the more power you have. It's not necessarily always, that's the case even in very healthy democracies, is the size of your budget corresponds to the influence you have. And that's why traditionally ministers of finance are immensely powerful because they control the purse strings. In South Africa, we have this bizarre situation where our minister of finance is impotent. No one thinks he really controls the purse strings. But whether it is, a patronage network or whether it is just the ability to call the shots in government, it would be greatly beneficial to Mkhize's political ambitions to gain control of a massive, massive bulk of state expenditure. But a few things that we must also add is, I think in your question to John was, does this damage the credibility of the NHI? I don't think it does, because you're assuming there's something to damage. The NHI here is something with really, really flimsy grounding. If you look at the pilot projects, the NHI pilot projects, Nick, you and I were planning to visit these, and then COVID-19, just struck and cancelled those plans. But if one investigates the pilot projects of where this NHI, tested its facilities, its validity, its credibility, it's really failure after failure after failure. So the NHI in and of itself is a problematic system. So beyond that, if we look at corruption broadly, we have to keep on making this point. Corruption is not the illness in South Africa. It is a symptom. If you're going to have a state that is the biggest spender, you're going to have a state that is going to be the biggest looter. It is really just as simple as that. So if you want to really turbocharge corruption in South Africa, give the government control over assets and pensions, and give the government control over medical schemes and funds and related things. The danger here is quite enormous for ordinary South Africans to lose their medical coverage, not because it might go to a corrupt politician, it probably will, but the corrupt politician being able to put his or her hands into your wallet and take your money is made possible by a matter of ideology, by government control. And the fact that we cannot really trust the thing fundamentally in and of itself, we cannot trust the people who should implement it, really should send every alarm bell that you have pealing.
Definitely. So, John, my read on the last year or so and the government's desperate attempts to centralize every single possible decision-making process in the country into the hands of the Command Council or Cabinet, we haven't seen particularly good results from that. The economy's taken a massive hit. The virus has been out of control. Vaccine program in South Africa continues to be one of the worst, not just by sort of wealthy country standards, but by international standards flat, even compared to other African countries. Where do you think, or do you think they're going to just continue to push ahead of it in the face of all of this? Is the ideology so overpowering?
Yes. So I think that's actually a good link back to the point Herman was making, which is related to the ideology. And an observation that I like repeating is that various people may observe the same facts and draw very different conclusions about what leads to those facts and what should be done to change those facts. And the situation we have in South Africa is that the government and organizations like ourselves agree on the problems, that unemployment is too high, growth is too low, the public sector is underperforming, et cetera, et cetera. And our advice based on those observations is that the government should do less. It must decentralize. It must create more scope for innovation, for experimentation, for innovation, for flexibility, and trust people to try things out and find the best way of doing things. Now, the government has a completely different interpretation of what should be done. And its interpretation is that the failures, which are manifest now, are a result of too little intervention. And therefore, the conclusion is that more intervention is required to fix the problems that we face. And we are able to predict, I think, with a high degree of certainty, that increasing intervention will continue to lead to worse outcomes. And that is a message we keep repeating. Decentralization is what we should be doing. Subsidiarity should be our approach. In other words, decisions should be made at the lowest possible level rather than at a centralized level. And this form of experimentation, variation, competition between different solutions is really what leads to the best solutions. And that is not what we're getting at the moment.
Definitely. The one-size-fits-all approach is not working for South Africa right now. Anyway,
Nick, if I could briefly add something on that. There's a positive and a negative case to be made for, you know, limited state involvement. The positive case was, I think, made very powerfully by the current president of Botswana shortly before or after taking office, President Masisi, when he said that the public sector, the size of the public sector crowds out the room for the private sector to innovate and to grow. And I mean, you had me at innovate. So the one thing is that the private sector really is better at getting to solutions for various reasons. So that's a positive case. The negative case is if you consider the cost of failure. If you have a central decision-making body like the NHI or in the hands of the government and something goes wrong, it goes massively wrong. If you have failures within a free market system, they are contained by the various sizes of the entities. Now, of course, that's not perfect. It's not going to protect people from the failures of business or commerce or finance. But it's slightly like, you know, the philosophy behind the Titanic, which might be a bad metaphor because it ultimately sunk. But the good thing about a free market decentralized system is not just on the positive, it's better solution side. It's that it minimizes risk because when things go wrong, it's always the most vulnerable people suffering. So if we have all eggs in one basket, and we know who's carrying that basket, and we know that basket is quite a terrible basket, the negative case to take the eggs out of that basket, to protect the eggs from a risk, not just to allow for opportunity, is a very, very powerful one.
Yeah. Imagine a situation where the provinces could have rolled out vaccinations, as well as private companies. What we would have seen is variable levels of performance across provinces and across other actors like companies and medical groups and so on. And that would have been fine because we could have seen the good ones, the high performing ones, and emulated them and strengthened them and stopped doing the things that weren't working. But with a single rollout scheme under the government, this is exactly what we're seeing at the moment, what you point out. When it fails entirely and there's no backup.
Definitely. Definitely. And obviously NHI is something that we will continue to campaign against and fight through any attempt to get it in, implemented and made into law.
I'm going to be an awful podcast guest because I want to quickly add something very, very swiftly there.
Very briefly.
The NHI excuse that poor people need free healthcare, I have a lot of sympathy and time for that reasoning. The problem is that completely overlooks the existing failures. In South Africa, people are want to compare the NHI right. in South Africa.
People already have free healthcare in this country. It's just exactly. It doesn't work is the problem.
Exactly. People are want to compare the NHI in South Africa to the NHS in the UK, saying, well, it works in the UK, it should work here. Two completely separate things. The one is actually a healthcare provider, and the other one is a funding mechanism. And in South Africa, we already have the equivalent of the NHS. It's already supposed to provide free of care, free of charge care to vulnerable South Africans. So yes, we can look at the problem and say not enough poor people have access to good healthcare, but then you can't task the people responsible for the first failure to somehow be responsible for the next success. So people should be very, very careful about, we're not saying poor people don't deserve healthcare, it's just there are different ways, as John says, to solve this problem much more effectively.
Yeah, you also shouldn't try to solve the problem by destroying the part of the system that actually does work well, which is what NHI threatens to do for the private medical health sector. Anyway, let us move on to the Zondo Commission, which you know we come back to from time to time, the endless commission that seems to end in no prosecutions. And as far as I can tell, it's just Judge Zondo going slowly crazy himself up there as he realizes that the depth of decay is very great, and yet that he has almost no power to do anything. And of course, former SAA chairman Dudu Mayeni, who is rumored to have been a girlfriend of former President Jacob Zuma, had, I think yesterday, not shown up to the state capture inquiry to testify, despite being ordered to do so. This is the second time she's done this. The first time she claimed that she didn't have enough money to travel to the inquiry because she couldn't afford it. She also unmasked a witness whose identity was not supposed to be known by the public, and she's facing a criminal charge for that. And we were going to talk about this on the show yesterday, but we didn't have time. And she did show up today at the Zondo Commission to give testimony. Upon taking the stand, she immediately said that she wanted to respond in Zulu rather than in English, because she said that this would allow her neighbors and people close to her to follow the inquiry properly. George Zondo pointed out, however, that she had had plenty of time to tell them in advance that she wanted to do this. She had made no indication that this was what her plans were, and so they said, he said, give the thing in English and we'll translate it into Zulu afterwards, and you can give it to whoever you want. During her the interrogation of her, she was interrogated specifically about a meeting that other witnesses had alleged happened, where she was supposedly handing out orders from Zuma to other people with regards to how they were going to sort of take over various state-owned enterprises. She said that she didn't remember any details from these, and basically just gave them the runaround. She said at one point, this commission loves Mr. Zuma. It adores Mr. Zuma, even when the events have nothing to do with him. So I think that gives you a pretty good idea of this. But for me, this really is a little bit of a continuation of Zuma's refusal to appear before this commission, despite a constitutional court ruling that he should. Herman, your thoughts on Dudu Mayeni and on the rule of law in general in South Africa and how Zuma is affecting it?
Settle in, everyone. I've got hours on this. I think a few things that we must realize is that God gave us commissions of inquiry so that we can have an understanding about what eternity might feel like. The point of a commission of inquiry, time immemorial, has been an opt-out for cowardly governments. Instead of a policy, instead of action, you know, you outsource a decision to be made by some sort of person somewhere that vaguely in a robe that makes you look like you're actually doing something about something. The problem is, however, that South Africa has a very, very, very poor history of these sorts of commissions. Perhaps if we go to the I'm very biblical today. If we go to the original sin the arms deal and the Sariti Commission and the absolute farce that turned out to be, in fact, being set aside a year or two ago for just ignoring tons and tons of information, it really gives you an idea as to the usefulness of you know, a commission of inquiry similar to, I don't know, a knitted condom. So the thing that we have here is not only a cowardly mechanism by a government that wants to seem to do something without actually doing something. They are, by instituting a quasi-judicial entity to actually deal with a political problem, you devalue judicial entities and processes more broadly. If you're going to give something like the public protector or a commission of inquiry some sort of judicial standing, and you allow, because of your political constraints, for disrespect to be shown to those procedures and the involved, you know, actions, you drip feed fundamentally a toxicity into respect for the rule of law. And before we started recording, I think that we mentioned the best way to look at it is disrespect of the rule of law is nothing but a slippery slope. So I have a problem with the Zondo Commission. It's pointless. It's a band-aid over cancer. And it really gives the government an opt-out for actual action, but it also has this danger of downstream consequences of judges, the judiciary, through the disrespect of quasi-judicial entities, just being shrugged at by either people who should be held accountable by them, or people who, like you and I, should have faith in our justice system to actually find wrongdoing and remedy it. So I have a very, 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 very strong dislike. I don't know if, you know, it was picked up. I hide these things well. For commissions of inquiry, I think they are a pox on democracy and a pox on the rule of law.
I think it's even worse than that, in that it's going to probably be used. Maybe the commission will finish before the local government elections, who knows. And President Ramaphosa will declare the thing over and then say, ah, you see, and now we've had all this catharsis and all the stories have come out, and now we can move forward. Yeah, not anyone going to jail.
It's a perverse TRC for the ANC's corruption.
Right. John, your thoughts on this, on the rule of law, and what Herman has just said about commissions of inquiry?
Yeah, so this topic gets me hot under the collar, and I think many other South Africans as well. And the aspect that jumps out at me is that of Section 9 of the Constitution, which says that everyone is equal before the law and has the right to equal protection and benefit of the law. And we're seeing so many stories at the moment where this is clearly not true. You know, we see it with ex-President Zuma himself, for example, refusing to appear before the commission, violating various orders, dragging out his court cases on spurious grounds, as Dudu Mayeni is doing now as well. You know, she's really making a farce of the process. She's showing huge disrespect to the law. You know, whatever you might think of commissions of inquiry, we have a very senior judge presiding, a powerful commission, you know, it has the power to order people to appear before it on pain of punishment. And still she plays games like this. And this is really an affront, I think, to the innate sense of fairness that South Africans have, where they say, you know, people must be treated equally by the state and by the law. And this clearly isn't happening. If you're well connected in South Africa, if you're a high ranking politician or the alleged former president's girlfriend, you can get away with pretty much anything. And that's what makes me really, really angry. I saw earlier on Twitter, there was a promoted tweet by the South African Revenue Service threatening employers who do not submit their payroll tax reconciliations by 31st May with imprisonment and fines. Yet it has now come to light that the ANC itself did not submit such reconciliations. And, you know, you say, okay, well, let's see the treasurer of the ANC in jail. You know, let's see those fines. But these standards are not being applied to the government, to the ANC, and that is deeply upsetting. And I think that is also ultimately where this, the threat to the rule of law comes from, because people start doubting whether the law really is impartial. They start doubting whether the law really has teeth. They start doubting whether the right judgments can be reached before the person in question dies of old age, like President Zuma might, before there are any consequences for him. And that is really the disaster here. And it is insidious. It is very, very bad for the country, very bad for society, and very bad for the rule of law. So it is a very serious issue.
Definitely. And what's even more horrifying is that I think Zuma is actually quite a healthy dude. He doesn't drink. He's, I think, actually quite modest in a lot of these things. So I think he's got many more years left in him. And I also think that he won't go to prison in that time. Anyway, let us very briefly move on in the last few minutes to a fairly interesting discussion. And we're not going to have a lot of time to discuss it, but it is, I think, worth thinking about. And that is, this has come into the news. It's gone around a little bit on social media, and I think it all follows a court case. So as many South Africans know, polygamy is under certain types of traditional law considered a legal form of marriage, that is a man marrying multiple women. However, I believe there is now a case in one of South Africa's courts which may result in a woman marrying lots of men, that is polyandry, as legal, because currently it's unclear as to whether that is, you know, considered legal under traditional law. This has stirred quite a lot of opinions and divisions, actually in interesting places. I saw there was a fight on Twitter between South Africa's most famous polygamist, who actually has a TV show about his lifestyle and his wives, where he was attacked by Rudi Klabi after he came out against polyandry, where she said, "This doesn't concern you, this concerns women, men shouldn't have a voice on this." The ANC in KwaZulu-Natal has come out very strongly opposing polyandry and saying that there is nothing equal about it. They said, "We are opposed to polyandry. We don't think there's any value in encouraging women in our country to be married to more than one husband. There is nothing equal about that. When I say nobody has convinced us about the rationality around it, it's not because we think there is a convincing and existing explanation somewhere. It doesn't exist." So, John, I'm going to start with you on this. My understanding of South Africa's sort of legal framework and the way we look at law and equal protection and stuff in this country is that it's going to be very difficult to stop polyandry being recognized as legal if polygamy is legal.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much my take as well. What's good for the goose is good for the gander. And if you allow men to marry multiple women, then you should also allow women to marry multiple men. It also raises the question of to what extent the state should be able to dictate the private living arrangements of people. It's not a question of encouraging polygamy or polyandry, but of allowing it to be a choice that people make. And I think on that grounds, my position would be, sure, you know, if polygamy is allowed, that polyandry should also be allowed, and people should be able to make that choice, even knowing that it can lead to quite a few complications. You know, it's just, I think, more complicated to manage relationships between more than two people if they are sort of intimate and close relationships. But that is a choice people should be allowed to make.
Herman, very briefly, your thoughts on this?
Well, prepare yourselves for the baby and the bathwater, because I think government has no business in marriage whatsoever. If people ask me, am I against gay marriage, I say, well, I'm against government-sponsored gay marriage. If they then react horribly, as I hope they will, I just respond, well, I'm against government involvement in straight marriage as well. The point here really is the government has no business, I think, regulating marriage. It has a business regulating contracts. And if you want to take a contractual agreement and make something cultural or religious from it, that should be your freedom. I'm a committed Christian. I would want a straight, you know, down the middle picket fence type of monogamous Christian marriage. And I would want people in the church to be there to witness this glorious event that is currently, well, fictitious and probably might never occur. But that's beside the point. the problem here is whenever the government starts getting involved in stuff that really has nothing to do with it, you always end up in a dangerous zone. And I'm going to echo John's sentiments here. How about we let people decide how they want to live their lives? If they want to be, monogamous, go for it. If they want to be whatever the polygamist, whatever. Let people live the way they choose to. And that's something that really distinguishes classic liberals from conservatives. We have moral values and we support these things, and communities have rights and the right to determine their own cultures and rituals and stuff like that. We just don't think the state has any business in prescribing how people should live or whose values they should fundamentally adopt in things like this.
Yeah, agreed. I think this is going to be an interesting debate to watch because it's drawing a lot of interesting lines and divisions through society that I think you don't often see. And it's kind of, it's a weird clash of old traditions, which are a bit vague and not always entirely firmly set down, and a kind of new, very equality-focused modernity sort of way of looking at things. And I think from a sort of purely academic intellectual standpoint, this is going to be a fascinating debate to watch. But I do agree with your points, John and Herman. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank you very much for listening or for watching. If you want to support us, that is the IRR and the Daily Friend. You can SMS your name to 32823 or go to our website, irr.org.za, and click the join button. You see, Herman is taking a risk because he doesn't know that I'm showing the banners, but he can see them. Anyway. We'll see you tomorrow, and I hope that you have a lovely day. Cheers, everyone.